This is Age of Treason Radio. On the White Network.
And Daddy always smiled, took me by the hand, saying someday you'll understand. Well, I'm here to tell you now that you never mother's son. You better learn it fast, you better learn it young, for someday it never comes.
With your host, Tan Stoffel.
The title of this installment is Jewish Crypsis, Religion, Part 1. This is going to be about what's often referred to as Judaism, Jewishness as a religion. And what I'd like to do here is explore what that means, and mainly because it disturbs me to see fairly frequently the excuse or the dodge that Jewishness is religion, the equation, the equating of Jewishness with religion. And I know that that's not true. And so I'd like to review what the Jewish religion is. And the first thing about the Jewish religion that I can say is, what religion? Which one? Because there are so many facets to it, it's almost it's bewildering. It's overwhelming, really. And I thought I knew something of it, and then when I sat down to actually research for this installment, I found myself amazed at just how much there is and how overwhelming it is. So right at the start here, I want to admit that I'm no religious scholar. Of any religion, much less of Judaism, and I don't purport to be. I'm going to come at this from the point of view of an intelligent layman who's trying to understand. But I'm skeptical, of course. I don't take the Jews at their word about everything. But for the most part, what I'm going to do here is cover the most prominent aspects, the most prominent facets of what is described as Jewish religion and how the Jews themselves describe it. And even from a mainstream source, for the most part, I'm going to cite from Wikipedia articles on these subjects. Because I think in the cases where I'm citing, there isn't really any controversy about the meanings, the broad understanding of some of these concepts. And I'll insert my own skeptical comments in between reading passages describing these things. So the first thing I want to start with is these terms that are often heard, orthodox and conservative and reform, as describing different types of Jewish religion, different intensities, really, is what it comes across as, the orthodox being the most Jewish, really, and the conservative being somewhat more lenient, and the Reform, which are also known as liberal or progressive, Jews being more liberal, more lenient. And in fact, one description that I read somewhere, I don't even recall now, having reviewed so much, was that the conservatives relative to Orthodox believe that some things can change for Jews as a group over time, and that the Reform believe that some things can change even per individual Jew, that it's sort of up to the individual Jew to pick and choose what they believe, what aspects of the religion they believe or don't believe, and even to the extreme of not believing in God, atheism, which I'll get to in a later installment, I think. In this one, I'm going to talk about starting with the Torah. And what is the Torah? Torah is five books, supposedly, according to the Jews, dictated to Moses by God himself and memorized by Moses and passed on orally to other Jews for a very long time, happened a very long time ago, and then for a very long time, Jews passed on what is called the Torah by word of mouth entirely. The way the Wikipedia article on Torah describes it is, at the time, meaning the time of Moses, and in that time when it was oral, it was forbidden to write and publish the oral law, as any writing would be incomplete and subject to misinterpretation and abuse. And right here from the get-go, we see, even in the most basic elements of the, describing their own religion, Jewish dishonesty and making things up. The idea that Jews kept this law oral and didn't write it down was because it might be misinterpreted is the exact opposite of reality. Of course, if you pass things on verbally, like the phone game, as many people who have played the phone game understand from a very early age, passing things on orally is inviting it to be distorted and disrupted and misinterpreted. So there must have been some other compelling reason for them to have kept what was in the Torah to themselves and oral. Wikipedia article goes on, however, after exile, dispersion, and persecution, this tradition was lifted when it became apparent that in writing was the only way to ensure that the oral law could be preserved. After many years of effort by a great number of Tanim, the oral tradition was written down around 200 CE by some rabbi. Let me just skip a few bits here. Anyway, the point about this, these couple of paragraphs, there's another point to make here about this, and that is this collective Jewish decision-making, which is just taken for granted here, not even really commented on. The decision, first of all, to keep it oral, that there was some sort of Jewish consensus, and then that there was a Jewish consensus suddenly after persecution to lift that ban on writing and start writing it down. And this speaks to the issue of conspiracy and the fact that Jews come to these kind of consensuses about what the Jews collectively should do or shouldn't do. And here it is. It's just taken for granted. It's not described as a conspiracy, but that it is evidence of Jews coming to a collective, having a debate about it, and then coming to a collective decision that they adhere to collectively. And the final paragraph after the bit that I want to skip there is, after continued persecution, more of the oral law was committed to writing. And so we see here another major theme of Judaism, which is this persecution. In fact, I would go so far as to say that that is the defining characteristic of Jews, is this self-image of themselves as a persecuted group. And it's a core belief of Judaism, even down into the religion. You know, not even thinking about Jews as a religion, you might think, well, it's a characteristic of Jews personally, that it's in their personality, it seems, to whine and complain about how they've been persecuted as a group. Well, we see here it goes even into the roots of their religion, which is what it meant to be a Jew for thousands of years, and until recently, it was being religious was what it meant to be a Jew. But this review, of course, is going to show the various facets and differences of those supposedly religious beliefs. What the Torah is basically a list of laws and rules and some history of the Jews as a people. You could say also that it's a how-to guide for us versus them thinking, and including how to take care of them, which means, in a lot of cases, genocide. Another paragraph from Wikipedia says that one Kabbalistic interpretation is that the Torah constitutes one long name of God, and that it was broken up into words so that the human minds can understand it. And I wanted to throw that in there. We're going to talk a little bit about Kabbalah and Kabbalistic interpretation a bit later. But this gives this sort of flavor of it, this mystical idea that the five books of the Torah are actually just one long name of God. The Torah is key to what it means to be a Jew, at least in a religious sense, in that basically all flavors of religious Jews agree upon the Torah and its significance at the root of Jewish religion. And it even reaches across into what's called the so-called Abrahamic religions, which includes, besides Judaism, Christianity and Islam. What to the Jews are the five books of Moses, Christians call the Pentateuch, or the first portion of the Old Testament, and Muslims call it the Torah, and they see Jews and Christians as people of the book, which I remember learning about when I was interested in understanding Muslims and Islam. And they consider Moses and many other of the Jewish prophets and significant figures from the Torah and other works to be prophets or at least religiously significant as well in their own religious thinking. Now, beside the Torah is a larger work in which the Torah is embedded called the Tanakh. This comes in three traditional subdivisions, the Torah being the first part, also known as teachings, and then the Nevi'im, or prophets, and the Ketuvim, the writings. And these things are familiar to Christians as the Old Testament as a whole, the first five books being taken pretty much as is, and these other two parts, bits and pieces, various sects of Christianity agree and disagree about exactly which ones are adopted into their version of the Bible, of the Old Testament, of their Bible. And one significant thing about this adoption by Christians of this Tanakh is that the adoption of, and I'm going to read here from the Wikipedia article again on the Tanakh, the adoption of the Christian chapter divisions by Jews began in the late Middle Ages in Spain, partially in the context of forced clerical debates, which took place against a background of harsh persecution. There's the persecution again. And the Spanish Inquisition. The debates required a common system for citing biblical texts. This is the interesting part. From the standpoint of the Jewish textual tradition, the chapter divisions are not only a foreign feature with no basis in the Masorah, and I forget what that is, but are also open to severe criticism of three kinds. So, you know, basically, the Jews don't give the names that Christians think of these various books of their Old Testament as. The Jews don't give them those names, and they don't break them up in the same way. And they consider, in fact, that Christian aspect of their work to be alien and unwelcome. Now, there's another significant work called the Talmud. And confusingly enough, it's sometimes referred to as the Oral Torah. But as I described, the Torah itself, the written Torah now, was originally oral. So it's kind of confusing to try and separate out what they mean when these Jews are describing their various religious texts. But the Talmud, as I say, is also referred to as the Oral Torah. The Talmud has two components, the Mishnah, which is the first written compendium of Judaism's oral law, and the Gemara, which was written later, and it's an elucidation of the Mishnah. It's sort of explanation or critique or thoughts on the first part. And the Mishnah is written in Hebrew. The Gemara is written in Aramaic. Much of the Gemara consists of legal analysis, and this is good, I think, for describing how the two parts relate to each other. The starting point for the analysis of in the second part is usually a legal statement found in the Mishnah. In the first part. The statement is then analyzed and compared with other statements. Another important function of Gemara is to identify the correct biblical basis, biblical meaning the Tanakh or Torah, for a given law presented in the Mishnah, and the logical process connecting one with the other. This activity was known as Talmud, long before the existence of the quote-unquote Talmud as a text. So this was an interesting thing that I didn't understand, that I didn't know. But Talmud can refer just to that study, to that activity of perusing these sacred, significant Jewish texts and connecting them to each other. Can be. I've often thought of that as Talmudism, but Jews themselves just refer to that as Talmud. Talmud, almost like study, with that particular meaning to the purpose of the study. In fact, nothing is simple with the Jews. The Gemara actually comes in two flavors, or two versions, representing two major centers of Jewish scholarship that generated them, the land of Israel and Babylon. The older compilation is called the Jerusalem Talmud, or Talmud Yerushalmi. It was compiled in the 4th century in Israel. The Babylonian Talmud was compiled about the year 500 CE, although it continued to be edited later. They say in Wikipedia that the influence of the Babylonian Talmud has been far greater than that of the Jerusalem version. They don't explain why in that article, and I would just, to hazard a guess here, it's because, from what I know, that the, ironically enough, the Jews that went off to Babylon in the supposed captivity actually stayed Jews and stayed more integral as a race, as a biological group, than the Jews that stayed behind in Israel, who mixed. And when the Jews from Babylon eventually came back to Israel, they were not very happy with what they found. And so today, that's sort of described as, well, you know, we don't really need that Jerusalem stuff that was generated by those guys. We're going to stick with the Babylonian Talmud. And in fact, when they refer to Talmud, if they don't specify, what they're talking about is the Babylonian Talmud, because it is considered more influential, more important. Here's one offhand statement from the Wikipedia article about the Talmud. It says, the Talmud is often cryptic and difficult to understand. Yeah, no kidding. Even the descriptions of the Talmud. I mean, I'm trying to give you here a digested form of what I've learned in an organized fashion. It's very difficult to piece this stuff together. If you just look up something that you want to understand, like Talmud or like Torah or whatever, you end up in this spider's web of interconnected ideas that are all alien and unfamiliar. All of this stuff, except for maybe one out of every 10 or 20 things, was completely unfamiliar to me as recently as 5 or 6 years ago. And it's only I learned as much in the past hours of studying this as I had learned even in the previous 5 or 6 years about this stuff. So it's complicated. And I think it's intentionally that way. A little further on in the article, they mention the word pilpul. And this is an interesting word. This is one of the 10 or 20 thing, one in 10 or 20 things that I did, had run into and thought I understood, which, it describes pilpul as a whole movement. During the 15th and 16th centuries, a new intensive form of Talmud study arose. Complicated logical arguments were used to explain minor points of contradiction within the Talmud. The term pilpul was applied to this type of study. Eventually, the word pilpul, I guess because the arguments became so tedious and ridiculous, that the word pilpul actually acquired a pejorative meaning. But it's the reason I became familiar with the word is because I had seen it in the context of this Talmudic or Talmudism tendency, this tendency for Jews to engage in hair splitting, to argue just incessantly and almost pointlessly these tedious arguments that they will make. And I think this, the meaning of the word pilpul, when you explore and you see where it comes from, you see that the need for it arises out of the contradictions that are created by Jews themselves, by their own dishonesty about who they are and what they think, and trying to cover it up, trying to explain it away. The central argument that Jews argue about, the central question, is what's good for the Jews? And when they're not arguing honestly amongst themselves, more or less honestly, you know, in code and through metaphor, they argue pretty directly about it with themselves, then they argue with the people around them that that's not what they're really arguing about. What they're really arguing about is God and religion and whatever else. The history of the Talmud reflects in part the history of Judaism, persisting in a world of hostility and persecution. Again, with the persecution. So the Torah was written in reflects the history of persecution. The Talmud, same thing. It's that recurring theme, as I said, of the central characteristic, the core characteristic of what it means to be a Jew is this belief in their own persecution as a group. Forever. A pretty interesting section of this article in Wikipedia on the Talmud. They get into deep into the article. I'll just start reading here. Full-scale attacks on the Talmud took place in the 13th century in France, where Talmudic study was then flourishing. The charge against the Talmud was brought by a Christian convert, Nicholas Donin, and I'll link to him, and you can read about him. What I found interesting about this section was this series of converts. These are Jews who supposedly converted to Christianity. And they were the source of – they were the high points of these full-scale attacks on the Talmud. They were basically – well, let me list out who they were again. The next one that's listed is another Christian convert, Pablo Cristiani, who was actually inspired by Nicholas Donin, sort of a contemporary. Later on, it says that in 1415, that Pope Benedict the 13th issued a papal bull forbidding the Jews to read the Talmud and ordering the destruction of all copies of it. By the way, that's the very first attack, the Nicholas Donin one, resulted in the burning of copies of the Talmud. What they're trying to get at here is this irrational book burning, you know, that it was for no reason whatsoever, of course. But as I say, the pattern here, and it lists in the paragraph about Pope Benedict XIII, that far more important, the Jews pretty much ignored Pope Benedict's edict and his book burning, but far more important were the charges made in the early part of the 16th century by another convert, Johannes Pfefferkorn. And the pattern here is of Jews who convert to Christianity and then rat out the Jews. They reveal the secrets that are in this Talmud, and they reveal the conspiracy of the Jews to which the Talmud is key. At least they believe it's key, and they believe that destroying the Talmud would help to destroy that conspiracy. The sense I get from reading the articles about these various convert traitors to the Jews is that they weren't really so much traitors to the Jews. The Jews see them that way. But what they were doing was they had decided to convert, that that was best for themselves and their families. And they tried to argue that that would be the best thing for the Jews too, and that the Jews should just convert to Christianity too. They didn't necessarily argue that the Jews should stop being Jews, just that they should convert and better assimilate. And of course, most Jews resisted the calls to do that. And in fact, even the book burning is kind of a false hope because, at least according to the Jews, what are encoded in books now and even then had originally started out as an oral tradition. And Jews get by just fine passing things on by word of mouth if they have to, which is what they would do if they were forbidden to have the books in the first place. The article on the Talmud concludes with a section labeled Contemporary Accusations, talking about criticism of the Talmud being widespread now in great part through the Internet. And the Anti-Defamation League is upset about this. They say that the critics of the Talmud frequently use erroneous translations or selective quotations in order to distort the meaning of the Talmud's text and sometimes fabricate passages. Well, that's easy to do, even innocently, because there are different versions and because it's written so cryptically to begin with in an alien language. And so who knows what's really in there? This is crypsis. This is the side effect of Jewish crypsis. The Jews hide who they are and keep their secrets and act secretive. And then when people get upset about it, when people are disturbed by it, the Jews blame them for being upset about it. It's right out of the Jewish playbook. This is what the Jews do. Not just in this case, but in general. What they're doing is they're playing on non-Jew confusion and ignorance that they themselves cultivate to begin with. The fact is, though, that whatever confusion there is or translation problems there are with the Talmud or taking things out of context, it doesn't keep the Talmud from being central to Jewish identity. The context, anyway, when Jews use that word, it needs context. It just means Jewish spin, anyway. It means the Jewish narrative, explaining things, excusing the Jews, and blaming it all on everybody else. The Jews aren't so broad-minded about things that they don't like that they want banned. Another aspect of Judaism that I wasn't really very familiar with is this document called Zohar and Kabbalah, which springs from it. And this is an aspect of Jewish religion that's secretive and obscure by design, and pretty openly it's acknowledged as being secretive. Zohar is the foundational work in the literature of Jewish mystical thought known as Kabbalah. It is a group of books including commentary on the mystical aspects of Torah. So in a way, it's like Talmud in that it's based on commentary on Torah, on the more foundational Jewish books and thinking. Contains a discussion of God, the origin and structure of the universe, the nature of souls, stuff like that. The Zohar is mostly written in Aramaic. Again, another obscure alien language. Now, this is they actually describe this Aramaic flavor that it's written in as dating back to 539 BC, which is odd because it first appeared in Spain in the 13th century, and it was published by a Jewish writer named Moses de Leon. He attributed it to another Jew, an earlier Jew, writing in the 2nd century, so almost 1,000 years earlier, named Shimon bar Yochai. But there's lots of speculation that he was the actual author, and he was just making that up. He was looking to profit from publishing this work. So, in conclusion, I want to say about Jewish religion, which religion? Judaism consists of a bewildering array of seemingly conflicting beliefs described in a wide variety of texts, more or less inaccessible to non-Jews. Jews are best understood as a people, not as a religion.